today. We've talked about Facebook and about Amazon. Now it's time to have a look at Google. And The Guardian's Lois Beckett after another two mass shootings in the US. Do Google know what I had for lunch?
They only know where you went for lunch, how long you stayed there, probably who you went with.
Alex Hearn is The Guardian's UK technology editor.
Maybe, depending on how you set it up, if you emailed about it, Google would know, you know, why you went, what you talked about over there.
What do you mean, what I talked about?
Well, as in, you know, if you emailed someone saying, you know, a lunch to talk about Today in Focus, then the fact that you were talking about Today in Focus. Of course, if one of you had an Android phone and the Google Assistant was accidentally triggered, then it will have also recorded a short portion of your conversation and sent that to Google servers as well. And they don't know what you ate, but they'll probably have quite a good idea from, you know, takeout receipts emailed to your Gmail account and all of the previous restaurants you've searched for on Google Maps. They'll have an idea of what you like to eat. So they could quite possibly combine that with knowledge of where you went to take a stab at what you ordered.
Unbelievable. And would they do anything with that data?
Not really. They don't care about most of it, but they still have it, and what they care about could change.
Given how much information Google holds about me, you, and all of us, what drives it really matters. The company's stated mission is to organise the world's information to make it universally accessible and useful. And it appears to be achieving its goal. But in doing so, has it ushered in a new age of mass surveillance? From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, are we right to trust Google with so much of our data?
It is the world's most popular search engine, allowing us all to find things very quickly and very easily.
But how much does Google know about you?
No one knows as much about its customers as Google.
Does Google, through this phone, know that I have moved here and moved over to the left? It's either yes or no.
Not by default.
But is Google really good, or is it evil?
So I remember when I was 18, just gone to university, I'd been using this thing called Yahoo, and then suddenly someone said, have you tried this new search engine, Google? And so I tried it like everyone else, and it was like, oh my God, this is so good. Just, I don't know why it was so good, but give me a sense of what has happened with Google since that point.
So Google Search is now the number one search engine in almost every country in the world. It owns and runs directly a web browser, which is the number one web browser in almost every country in the world. It owns and runs the world's largest video sharing site, YouTube. It owns and runs the world's largest webmail service, Gmail. It owns and runs the world's largest cloud productivity suite. So that's Google Docs with Google Sheets, Google
web cloud productivity suite.
Productivity suite. Well, that's not really an easy
is
way.
Is that how you say it in the pub?
A web replacement for Microsoft Office, but that rather downplays it. It's now probably used by more people than Office because it's free and it's online and you don't need to install any software for it. Maps. So they'll do your maps for everywhere. I think they also now categorize that as local search. They also, of course, the big one that I missed is Android. They own and run the world's largest mobile operating system and a whole bunch of services that go with that. They run the Android App Store. And then you've got all the stuff that's not Google, that the company that Google became, Alphabet, owns and runs. So you also have Waymo, a self-driving car company. You have DeepMind, an AI research project based in London. You have Verily, which is trying to research life extension technology. You have Jigsaw, which I think they describe as a do tank, as opposed to a think tank, which is trying to apply Google's technology to do things like solve interethnic conflicts.
It sounds like they've done pretty well.
They're big.
Very big.
They're a big company.
I mean, how big?
Well, they have at times been the largest company in the world.
And why are they so rich?
Because at its heart, And at the heart of its revenue, it is one thing. It is an advertising company. It sells advertising on YouTube. It sells advertising on Google searches. And it sells advertising on the rest of the web. A huge number of the adverts that you see on sites that have nothing to do with Google are provided by Google. They sell, with Facebook, most advertising on the internet. The internet is quite big and advertising is quite successful.
Why are they so dominant in ad terms?
The beginning of the story is about what a search ad is. A search ad was one of the first really valuable places to sell advertising on the internet. Because if you're searching for something, you're a really good person to advertise to because you are focused on one thing. So if you're searching car insurance, you are the best person in the world to buy an advert for car insurance and put it in front of, because there is no one in the world who is more clearly looking for car insurance than you at that moment. That was the idea that really gave Google its genesis. But from there, the reason why it's stuck around and why it's grown beyond Google search is that it's become extremely good at this personalization, at building these profiles of who you are, what you know, what you're interested in, what you like, what you read on the internet, maybe what you read off the internet if you buy it from companies that send email receipts to your Gmail account. All of this information goes into making sure that even when you're not doing something as obvious as searching for car insurance, you are still being given adverts by advertisers who are just that much more likely to get you to click on them or to get you to convert to a sale or just remember them.
What you're telling me is that Google got so massive and so rich because they found a way to collect the data from their products and to use that to sell masses of advertising, so much advertising that other companies can't come close. Just tell me about the way they collect data and how targeted they can get.
So I think the best way to phrase how they collect data, the way they collect data, is passively. They collect data by just sitting there and saving everything they're told. They weren't always like that. When Google was launched, they were very focused on the technology that they had built to provide the best search results. But gradually, this personalization started creeping in, both to the ad product and the main search, where they would try and look at what you clicked on and alter your personal search results to give you a better set of results. So they started saving search history and they started saving what you click on. And there's a bunch of things you can do with that. You can personalize search results. You can improve search results for everyone. And that approach to improving search and to improving the search ads has carried over to everything else Google does. I think a good way of putting it is that until very recently, it was a company that took the attitude of, if it gets information, it saves that information by default without thinking, without even really considering whether or not it has a use for it right now. Just in case somewhere down the line it can find a use, it will save it, store it and tag it and push it away in the depths of its servers.
I use Google quite extensively. Yeah. What sort of information have they collected on me?
So a lot of it is the obvious stuff, right? It's easy to forget, but all of your emails go through Google and Google has collected all of those emails. So that's one thing. Every email that you've received or sent, Google has collected. Google has collected every web search you've ever made. Google has collected, if you're on Chrome, every website you've ever visited. Even if you're not on Chrome, because of its advertising network, Google has probably collected a vast count of websites that you visited. Then there's the stuff that Google is explicit about, but kind of less open. If you use Google Maps,
I do.
Google has collected your location, wherever you are. Certainly every time you've got Google Maps open, and depending on your settings, a lot of the time when you've got Google Maps closed
well. Can you check my settings?
I can pull up your Maps location history right now. And this is a thing that they are commendably open about if you know where to look. It's not hidden away all that deeply. On the iPhone app, I'm hitting the menu bar. I'm going to, there we go. I'm going to your timeline. I click on that and you get a little thing. I can see that you've never looked at it because it's giving you the walkthrough. And you can scroll back to any day since you installed Google Maps.
What you're about to see in my phone is that I've got no security settings whatsoever. And you can track everywhere I've ever been. Okay, Google has the ability to know lots about you. But does it actually look at that information? Does it actually know that stuff?
It depends what we mean by know, doesn't it? So all of this information is stored on Google servers, all of this and more. But the company is quite careful about what it does with that information. It doesn't process it all. It doesn't use it all. A lot of it just sits there as unmodified text or unmodified audio. Google doesn't read the contents of your emails for advertising. So does it know what's inside them? Well, it still has the emails and they're sitting on its servers. So I'd say it knows. It would say it doesn't. It would say it stores that information, but insofar as a company can know stuff, it only knows the things it's processed.
Which is all fascinating that Google tracks all that information about me, is able to access, if it wants to, my emails. Why should we care about that?
My answer would be that normalizing this sort of surveillance in our lives, in our heads, in our feelings, is potentially really damaging. If you went back to 1992 and told citizens of East Germany that in 27 years you would be voluntarily uploading to a single monolithic American corporation all of your personal communications with everyone in your work and personal life, your physical location all through the day and night, as well as, for a lot of your contemporaries and colleagues, installing an always-on microphone in your house that can be activated accidentally and that has a link to that same monolithic company. I think a country of people who had just come out of the end of the Stasi's authoritarian rule would think you were insane. And reassuring them that you trusted that company wouldn't matter. It wouldn't change things because they have lived the experience of completely invasive oversight. And I think perhaps they would be too sensitive in 1992. And we are in a better world with amazing technology enabled by this. But we've never really had that conversation. And I'm not quite so sure that it's an open and shut case.
I'm not sure I even think of it as mass surveillance. When you put it like that, when you compare it to the Stasi 30 years ago, then suddenly it does seem much more chilling. And I suppose the issue is that we have decided as a society to trust Google.
And not wrongly. Google is not the Stasi. Google are not using this vast source of information they have to crack down on political dissent. But I trust Google now. I'm not sure there is any organization that would remain as unimpeachable as you need to remain for me not to feel fundamentally uncomfortable with that level of power and potential control. We've done the hard part of building the 21st century Stasi. The easy part is just who gets the information changing. Google in 2019 is not evil, but Google in 2029 might be, Google in 2039 might be, and whoever buys that data set from Google when it eventually collapses in 2099 might be the scum of the earth.
That is a scary thought. But if we just focus on 2019 for now, Google famously had the phrase, "Don't be evil," as its motto when it was first set up. But that was downgraded and then totally dropped last year. The parent company, Alphabet, still urges staff to do the right thing. And from everything you're saying to me, it seems incredibly important whether or not Google does that, whether or not we can trust it. Tell me what some of the concerns are about Google.
They firmly believe in the good of what they're doing to an extent that can make them blind to the damage that can be caused along the way. They firmly believe that, for instance, providing a platform to let people upload videos and express themselves is inherently good, and overlook the fact that that has been one of the greatest radicalizing forces of the last decade for purveyors of misinformation, for the far right. They believe in the goodness of making information freely available, which is great until you're in the business of charging for the gathering of that information, like the news industry, at which point Google cutting you off at the knees is less positive. They also haven't fully lived up to their values at times.
A few weeks back, we learned that Google was working on something called Project Dragonfly, a new search engine for the Chinese market, one that would function in compliance with Beijing's strict rules on censorship.
The company had been thrown out of China for their refusal to censor their search engine, to remove terms like Tiananmen Square from searches, and they started trying to find a way back in. But to Google's credit, that project was scrapped. And that project was scrapped because there was huge internal outcry from these you know, frankly, hippie Silicon Valley engineer types who still make up the bulk of the staff at the company, and they reversed course.
So when you think about your Stasi example, when they were faced with the kind of pressure of an authoritarian government, they did the right thing. But at the same time, lawmakers have accused Google of creating an automated advertising system so vast and so subtle that hardly anyone noticed when Russian saboteurs co-opted it in the last American election.
Coming up, Russia's Google connection and Google's Russia connection. Google, the latest big tech company to admit taking money from the Kremlin-sponsored hackers during last year's US presidential election. We'll discuss Google's role in fake news.
Yeah, Google is far too big and complex for anyone at Google to know everything that is happening on its property. People are paying Google for a service and Google still can't sit down and vet it and go through it.
And if we're thinking about whether we trust them, what we think of them, whether we like them, how do they treat their staff?
It's a complex one. There have been plenty of complaints about Google.
Another former Google employee is suing over issues of diversity.
Now, according to the court filing, the U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission is investigating the age discrimination claims.
More than 200 people who applied for jobs at Google but were not hired will be getting a settlement of $11 million.
But a lot of the problems that come out of Google are in a way a reflection of another positive about it, which is that it's far easier to complain about Google inside Google than it is at a huge number of other companies. And that's great, but it means that we hear these problems.
And how about how they treat their competitors?
They have been punished for the way they crushed rival shopping search services.
The internet giant Google is fined a record £2.1 billion for putting its own online shopping services at the top of search results. The European Commission said Google had abused its market dominance.
And then you had a bunch of complaints about Android, where Google was trying to crush mobile phone companies' ability to use multiple operating systems. Google used contracts to prevent that and again was slapped down by the European Commission.
That's some of the negative stuff. But the flip side is incredibly positive. This technology is changing our lives.
You know, this is a company that is explicitly trying to build an artificial general intelligence, a sentient computer. That is an explicit aim of one arm of Google. It's a company that's trying to extend the human lifespan. It cannot be overstated the wildly impressive technologies that Google has come out with, even in the last sort of 5 years. This is a company that runs a taxi service in Phoenix, Arizona, with no drivers. This is a company...
What do you mean with no drivers?
I mean, you will get in a Waymo car.
I will not.
I have. It drives pretty well.
Sounds like a train.
You get in the cars that Google makes, and you enter on a screen where you're going. And the car drives itself to where you're going in a major metropolitan area. That's amazing.
That's crazy.
You can ask your Google Assistant to make a restaurant booking and it will phone up the restaurant and have a conversation with the staff member at the restaurant, making a booking in your name, saying that it is your assistant, and then it will add that booking to your calendar. And frequently the restaurant worker won't even know they've spoken to a robot.
Alex, you do not think Google is evil, and yet how much do you use Google?
As little as I can. I have to for work because the Guardian services are managed through Google Apps for Business. But my search engine is a Google competitor called DuckDuckGo. I use Apple's Safari browser and an iPhone.
What's DuckDuckGo like?
DuckDuckGo it's fine.
It's not as good as Google, is it?
It's better than Google sometimes. It's worse than Google at other times.
I don't believe you. The reason I use Google Maps is because it's better.
I use Apple Maps.
But Google Maps is better.
Google Maps is better most of the time. But Apple Maps isn't keeping a long history of where I am on Apple servers.
Does Apple not collect your data?
Apple makes a lot of the fact that they don't want your data. It's partially because they're not in the business of making AI, they're in the business of selling shiny phones. And it's partially because for them, it's now become a really strong aspect of competition with Google.
But if, like me, you do use Google a lot, what can you do to make yourself less trackable?
you can go through the settings of services like Chrome and Google Maps, and you can turn off the history. Google has actually, to their credit, a very good centralized place for this. Myactivity.google.com will show you all of the activity you've got saved on Google from every product. You can set that to auto delete, or you can just clear it yourself manually periodically.
So where are Google headed?
In Google's vision of their future, they're headed to being a company that has an incredible artificial intelligence offering that will do all of the mundane parts of your life, will manage your life, will drive you to work, will do a significant chunk of your knowledge work for you when you're there, and then it will leave you to get on with the stuff you like. That's the world that Google is trying to build. But the fear is it never quite achieves that goal, and we end up with fine but not great versions of artificial intelligence being used to justify ever greater and ever more invasive collections of personal data without stopping to ask ourselves if that's actually a worthwhile trade-off.
Alex, as ever, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me.
That was Alex Hearn. We went to Google about this episode, who stressed that they do not read emails or offer services based on them. A spokesperson said, "We are focused on building an even more helpful Google for everyone. For us, that means making tools like Search, Maps, Gmail, and YouTube, which make your day easier. We're helping people access high-quality information, protecting their privacy, and keeping them safe online. We are optimistic about the evolving online world and the opportunity it can create for people." Coming up, dozens killed in another two mass shootings in America. Now, there have been 251 mass shootings in the United States in 2019, with the most recent this weekend in El Paso, Texas, and Dayton, Ohio. Lois Becker, a senior reporter at Guardian US, writes about gun policy and has been covering the latest incidents.
The United States has seen so many mass shootings that it feels like they're becoming routine. But what happened this weekend, two mass shootings in two cities in less than 24 hours, breaks that feeling of routine for everyone. The first shooting came Saturday morning in El Paso, Texas, a town on the border with Mexico, where after-school shoppers, parents, kids, grandparents, were targeted by a gunman with a military-style rifle. That evening in Dayton, Ohio, another young man with a rifle opened fire on a crowd of people in an entertainment district in the downtown. There's no clear connection yet between these two shooters. We do know that the shooter in Dayton, Ohio, according to reports, had a history of making threats about violence and rape towards his high school classmates when he was 17. It also appears that the shooter in El Paso on Saturday morning had posted a manifesto online. This was a white nationalist manifesto explicitly saying he saw his shooting as a response to what he called the Hispanic invasion of Texas. In the wake of the shooting, there was a lot of discussion in the media about what President Trump could do or say to unite the country, about whether he would denounce white supremacy. And a reporter on Sunday night asked 2020 Democratic presidential candidate Beto O'Rourke what he thought the president could do or say that would be helpful. And Beto had an extremely powerful response. He said, "Why are you asking this question? Why is anyone asking this question? We know that President Trump is racist. We know that the things that he has been saying about immigrants are the exact same thing that these violent terrorists are saying. Why are we still asking this question? Why are we treating this president like a normal president? We know his policies. We know his beliefs. It's time to stop pretending that we don't." On Monday morning, President Trump gave a press conference. He condemned white supremacy, he condemned hatred, but he pivoted very quickly to blaming these shootings on mental health and video games and the internet. And he said that it was mental health that pulled the trigger on the gun.
"Today, I'm also directing the Department of Justice to propose legislation ensuring that those who commit hate crimes and mass murders face the death penalty."
Earlier that morning, President Trump had sent out a tweet in which he suggested that he might support legislation to require universal background checks on every gun sale, but he said he also wanted immigration reform as part of the package. And that was a pretty astonishing thing for a president to say in that moment. The El Paso shooter had been opposed to immigration. He had purposefully targeted Hispanic immigrants. And here was the president saying that the response to the shooting should essentially be to give the terrorist what he wants. Trump has a history of supporting some gun control laws, and after mass shootings, he's repeatedly expressed a desire to make a compromise, a desire to sign some bipartisan legislation. Gun rights advocates don't trust him completely on this issue, but so far, Senate Republicans are holding the line, not letting anything pass. So the Republican governor of Ohio was speaking before a crowd of people trying to offer reassurances after the shooting, and people in the crowd started shouting at him and then chanting, "Do something."
We're here tonight.
It was a really powerful moment, and I heard this morning from one of the women who had chanted that in the crowd. And she said that she was incredibly frustrated by the governor's pro-gun positions and that she wanted to see Ohio politicians take action to pass gun control. It's a pretty frightening and overwhelming time in the United States, particularly for any of the many groups of people who have been targeted by white nationalist terrorism, African Americans, Muslims, Jews, now Hispanic Americans, leftist protesters and politicians. But it's important to remember that there is progress happening on preventing violence in America. It's just not happening in Washington. But at the state level, gun control laws are advancing, and some cities have seen big decreases in violence by focusing on the people at highest risk at the lowest level. It's hard to remember any of that right now, of course. That's one of the points of terrorism. It makes you exhausted and it makes you afraid, and it's hard to focus on anything else.
That was Lois Beckett. My thanks to her and to Alex Hearn. That's it for today. I hope you're enjoying Today in Focus. This episode was produced by David Waters, Elizabeth Cassin and Gary Marshall. Sound design was by Axel Cucoutier. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Nicole Jackson. We'll be back tomorrow.